It would be nice if they had a way of confirming that you have a handshake.
Well, it's 3:59.
My phone says it's 4:00.
Yeah, it's just slipped into the 4.
Well, hi, everybody. This is Dave. Welcome. Let's look at any questions or comments you have before we begin our final seminar today. And then remember, I'll be adding a bit of time at the end for discussion, for questions, and any discussion you have at the end as you reflect on what we've done during these 4 weeks. But for right now, any comments or questions or things you'd like to address before we start the seminar? Anyone, anything? Anything you'd like to be sure that we add in discussion before we sign off at the end of this seminar? Anything in reflecting back that you'd like a little bit more clarity or to elaborate and discuss a bit more, or any questions that haven't been answered? I've reviewed the ones you've sent in. I appreciate that very much. But anything else you want to add to those as you think about it now? Everybody satisfied? I'm surprised. Well, we'll move directly into the material. Final call. Any questions, comments, anything at all you'd like to discuss? Okay, I'll put us on lecture mode, and we'll move into the final seminar. Okay, we've discussed the first 5 steps of the roadmap. We're going to look at step 6 and 7 at this point. Step 6 is to author new experiences, to put everything that you've reflected on, decided, planned, mapped, to put it in an output channel. And this is an important aspect of what you do and how you move ahead, to put it into action, put it in an output channel, which completes the circuitry in the brain. So we trust our stories. They're our reality. If our stories and our behaviors don't fit, then we experience a kind of disharmony. So we have to change one or the other to restore harmony. Sometimes we revise our stories. Sometimes we just change how the way we see things. We've considered if your story doesn't allow you to do certain things. If your story is that you're a procrastinator, it'll disallow you from finishing early. If your story says you don't do technology well, you'll live out this assumption. So let's look very briefly at the dynamics of change itself. First, the idea of change will create excitement. That's the anticipation of something new. That's the dopamine system. Then, as it's on the cusp of action, anxiety. That's where your brain can't tell the difference between anxiety and excitement, and how you frame it will determine whether you proceed or whether you retreat. If you proceed, then expansion. If you don't, it's a reiteration of the old story. Then, after expansion, mastery. Now, there are a couple of additional aspects of experiencing change that can seem paradoxical. And I say this to you as mentor coaches so that you can hear this with your clients, perhaps even see it yourself. Every step forward means relinquishing a past position. So what that means is somebody's got to mourn. They've got to say goodbye emotionally and practically to a familiar, maybe long-held and practiced old story. This is a process. It's a developmental step. not something that you can just say and make it so, or recognize it, change it. To give up a habit is like saying goodbye to an old friend or a pattern of behavior, because that's a part of your identity. You come to see yourself as this collection of repetitions. Or a hope of getting the old story just right or doing it better that'll make it work. To give that up is a kind of mourning as well. No matter how maladaptive, the old story still has to be mourned. You have to say goodbye to it. And secondly, the more subtle aspect in learning something new and creating change is an injury to self-esteem. Because this carefully crafted story, and remember, for our clients, this is not a story. It's not an old story or a new story. That's our metaphor, our way of seeing things. To the client, this is just the way things are. So with this carefully crafted story, even with some aspects of identity attached, doing something new is replacing something that you've done before, only in a better way. So it's kind of an injury to self-esteem in that way, because you recognize that all the things you've been doing, there's a better way to do it. So let's look at this dynamic of change. There are at least six components that I see. Now, these are not headlines. These are not things that you'll see, signs that you can label, but these are to think about as conceptual markers as you're listening to your client. The myth that there's a perfect choice. The illusion that the perfect choice will solve all problems. The disappointment that nothing's really perfect. There isn't even an ultimate arbiter of fairness. That's also called adulthood. The development, the recognition that no one's going to take care of it for you. The growth, to take the next best action. And finally, the consolidation, which is a combined happy-sad experience. Happy about the autonomy of moving ahead and the experience of effectiveness, of not creating an obstacle, and sad about mourning an old story, especially one that has a part of your identity attached. So you'll see a number of these, the ABCs of financial mistakes that are listed and defined in your workbook. There are probably 25, 27. The ABC is simply the affect or emotional biases, the behavior biases, the cognitive biases, and the social biases. I want to pick just a couple of each of these to give you an illustration and encourage you to look at this list and the description in the workbook, because you'll be seeing some of these in many of your clients. So this is simply a way of organizing the most common financial mistakes in terms of the particular biases that we have to get a level of understanding. A compromised money behavior and financial decision can be categorized. I'm a lumper to lump things together rather than a splitter. So these four categories are affective, in other words, emotional biases, behavioral biases, cognitive biases, and social biases. Let me give you a couple of examples of each so that you'll be alerted to this. We've already discussed some in vignettes. So for affective or emotional biases, one is a nostalgia bias. We feel more nostalgic at difficult times. Let's think about during this time of the coronavirus, how much you've nostalgically looked back to the past, and man, if it were just like it used to be. Nostalgia, though, remembers things not as they were, but as we wish them to be. Airbrushed memories backlit by idealization. Nostalgia recalls the ideal rather than the real. Has anyone gotten worse in high school and college sports as the years go by? Or become less popular in memory replays? I'm really close to being All-State in basketball twice in one season, as I recall, probably by next year. And that also was, by the way, the season we were undefeated. Marketing taps into nostalgic experiences. It's easier and faster to associate with idealized memories than to create new product identification. The nostalgic trigger is coupled with new information. This coupling uses nostalgia to influence current choice. Remember the ad of Arnold Palmer and that old tractor? Two classics preserved by one particular motor oil. Another is invincibility bias. This is the seemingly inextinguishable sense of immortality we all have when we were young. There are still whispers of that adolescent invincibility in adulthood. In surveys, 19% of the population believe they're in the upper 1% of income. 90% of all drivers believe they're above average. I mean, I know that's not true here in Houston, at least. 75% of people believe they're healthier than average. And remember the tech rally investors in the late 1990s, the ones who couldn't lose? Another category, behavior biases. One example is transference fallacy. In psychoanalysis, the tendency to redirect feelings from a past context to a current one is considered a type of transference. Here's an example. Digital Equipment Corporation posted a 13% decline. Within minutes, Hewlett-Packard collapsed half of its value during that day. No relationship, except there was a carryover, a transference, because they were both the same kind of industry. Another example of behavior bias, spending justification, creating a just cause to spend. Someone takes money from retirement savings to spend with a justification of an immediate need being greater than an abstract future need of retirement. So the savvy mentor coach asks, how will you repay it? And if there's internal bargaining, it will be, well, I'm going to repay it next paycheck or next month. Or it may be vaguely dismissed with a vow to return the money at a future point. Neither of these is a plan. Another bias, the status quo bias. This is the resistance to leaving a comfort zone. The status quo bias is another name for inertia. The default option is always to stay in our comfort zone. One example, marketers know that when they give a free three-month trial, it's called a forced free trial, the inclination is to stay with a familiar and not cancel. In other words, somebody signs on for 3 months of a free subscription, but they have to give their credit card to do it. And the fourth month, they start charging your credit card for a subscription unless you unsubscribe. 75 to 80% of initial free subscribers do not cancel. Yet, over 70% do not read the subscriptions that they don't cancel. So, we tend to avoid information that causes distress. People stick with default choices, even when the choices are costly or compromised. So, the power of inertia can be strategically fashioned to produce better outcomes. One example, and we've touched on this before, is the automatic enrollment savings program for retirement. You decide, or a company decides, after an initial opt-in, or you set it up yourself, a specific amount that automatically gets deducted and put in your retirement fund every month. A good decision you make one time. Another category, the C of cognitive biases. Here's an example of a cognitive bias, diagnosis bias. We label a person or a situation, and then we seek data to confirm more vigorously, coupled with blindness to evidence that contradicts. And this is what we do with information. We seek information that validates what we already believe and give little attention to information that doesn't. Here's one example of that. Two economists, Barry Starr and Ha Wang, have studied skill categories and stats of new NBA players. They distill these stats into distinct skill measuring categories, scoring, quickness, toughness. They looked at all the variables that determined playing time in games, like skill categories, players' performance, injury or trade status. But there was one variable that had greater impact than any of these actual performance data to determine how much somebody played. It was the player's initial draft selection order. In the first 5 years, the draft order was more highly correlated with playing time in the NBA than any other factor. Now, even though skill and performance can determine a draft order, once picked, though, coaches and managers should only be interested in the player's performance. In other words, once the draft is over, the draft number is history, and performance is everything. Not so, says diagnosis bias, and sometimes flying in the face of actual performance statistics. So the fourth category, social biases. One is affinity bias, and I'm just naming maybe two or three that are most recognizable, perhaps most common. An affinity bias means simply that we underestimate the risk of things we like. We overestimate the risk of things we don't like foreign enemies or an out-of-favor investment. Let's say you lose $20 betting on a favorite in the Super Bowl. Well, we call it unlucky. Then you lose $1,000 betting your alma mater will win their college game, even though they have the worst record in the conference. That's affinity bias. Another, loss aversion. Selling a loser admits defeat. We tend to avoid pain. There's about twice as much bad feeling, and this is measured by the brain, associated with losing $100 than there is good feeling in gaining $100. Harry Markowitz won a Nobel Prize in economics for the mathematical breakthrough showing how to calculate a trade-off between risk and return in portfolio selection of stocks, although he also admitted he couldn't apply it to his own portfolio. He said, I visualized my grief if the stock market went up and I wasn't in it, or if it went down and I was completely in it. My intention was to minimize my future regret. So look at the remainder of the listing of the ABCs of financial mistakes to look at the four different categories of bias. And this is totally arbitrary on my part to list these under affective, behavioral, cognitive, or social biases. It kind of fits. I'm sticking with it. But look at the label of these and the description so that you might begin to recognize it if you experience it in yourself or with clients. So let's look now. We're looking at this next to last step in writing a new money story. So here are the most frequent mistakes made in writing a new money story. One, not knowing that you don't know. So how can people know that they don't know something? We believe we know, which blinds us to our ignorance. This, in turn, causes us to be blind to signs that we may be mistaken. To know to ask is half the answer. The beginner's mind keeps looking at things in new in different ways with fresh eyes. Two, stopping at the first right answer. When we're solving problems or writing a new story, we may stop at the first reasonable action. Now, this can be a correct strategy, but it also can stop us from considering other right answers, other correct strategies that may be even more effective. So ask yourself or your client, and then what? What else? I'm going to introduce number three with this brief quiz. Five frogs sat on a log. They all considered their options. Four, however, were very savvy, planned their strategy, and then decided they would jump off. So, how many were left? Well, five were left because they only planned and decided. They didn't commit to act. Number three is procrastination. I'm talking about some of the broad themes here, the big patterns. Putting off an exercise program, not paying yourself first, not saving for emergencies, not saving for retirement, taking care of others but not yourself. Most of us live our lives as though there were an unlimited amount of time left. Now, we know cognitively, intellectually, that time is finite and there's the illusion of immortality, but we may have little sense of urgency, and that can contribute to a lack of focus. When the two-minute warning sounds in football, a team sometimes achieves more in that final 2 minutes than they did in the previous 28. Now, the exception, of course, is the Houston Texans. This imminent deadline, a limited, finite amount of time to accomplish goals, focuses concentration and increases effort. In our lives, though, we only rarely have a two-minute warning. We play as if the notion of finite time is an abstraction, something we acknowledge but seem not to internalize. Life is finite. It's just that the game clock is invisible. 4. Inefficient energy management. Managing energy is a key to success. This begins with knowing your strengths, your limitations, your biorhythms, biological cycles, when you perform best, what kind of learning and performance style you have, what kind of personalities have, style you have, and how that fits with different tasks. Know how to enter and exit various states of mind and which works best for a particular task. For example, writing and editing, two very different states of mind, two different parts of the brain, to be done at two different times. I emphasize again, I think it would be worth your time to spend the 30 or 35 minutes on the free webinar on the homepage of MentorPath called Master States of Mind. There's a downloadable outline and a microsystem of a neuroconditioning chart that's part of that. Another cluster activities that require the same state of mind, so you're not always going back and forth and changing states because that requires a lot of energy. Identify what enhances your energy, such as anticipation, creativity, pleasure, meditation, prayer, and also identify what depletes your energy, maybe toxic people or situations, negative mindset, lack of focus. 5, ambiguity. If you're unclear about what options are available and don't quite know or have planned what it would be like to pursue them, since you haven't done it before, this uncertainty can add to decision paralysis. For a client, consider this. What looks like resistance can simply be a lack of clarity about what the next step is. People are more likely to change when a new behavior is clear, simple, specific, stepwise. Eat a healthier diet is vague and abstract. Save for the future, vague and abstract. Where do you begin? When you want to affect change, script specific behaviors. 6, too many choices. Some studies showed how an HR department or individual investment advisor can provide too many options, and the extra options can backfire, leading to decision paralysis. For every 10 options offered, the employee's rate of participation goes down by over 2%. At some point, choice debilitates rather than liberates, and someone retreats to the default mode of not making a choice. Remember the experience of there just seems to be so many things, and you take a nap instead of picking one thing. There's a classic study that began this whole area of recognition of decision paralysis. It was done at gourmet grocery stores on a series of weekends. They displayed 6 jams for tasting, and on the alternate weekend, there were 24 jams available for tasting. And for both of the weekends, customers were given a coupon for $1 off if they purchased a JAM. With the larger displays of JAM, it attracted more potential customers, more tasting. When 24 varieties were available for tasting, 3% purchase rate resulted. When only 6 varieties were available for tasting, purchase rate was 30%. Too many choices resulted in a tenfold decline of actual purchases. With too many choices, we feel overwhelmed and resort to our comfort zone to do nothing. 7, lack of persistence. The truly challenging, courageous part of change is not the initial decision or the initiation of a new order of things. It's a willingness to stay the course. A clearly defined goal can capture imagination and inspire passion. It can cut through the fog like a beacon in the night. One extra degree of effort in business and in life separates the good from the great. 51 publishers turned down Richard Bach to publish Jonathan Livingston Seagull. He took it to number 52. 141 publishers turned down a guy who then decided to publish his book himself and sell it out of the back of his car. It had a really unlikely and sort of goofy title for a book, Chicken Soup for the Soul. To get what you've never had, you'll probably have to do what you've never done. Lord Eliot put it very succinctly, perseverance is not a long race. It's many short races, one after the other. Success is never final. Don't get complacent. Testing is as important as postulating. Test your ideas out. Revise them. Make it your story, told with your voice. A fellow Texan named Ross Perot said, most people give up when they're about to achieve success. They quit on the one-yard line. 8, not following success trails. Have you said or had clients say some version of the following? Well, I want to change careers. I'm not sure what I do instead. I want to play a bigger game, but I don't quite know what it is. I want to create wealth, but I don't have a plan. Decide how you want to expand. Then pick success trails to follow. Watch someone who's doing what you might want to do. Pick their brain. Take them to lunch. Shadow them and observe, but make it your story. An example, when my good buddy Art heard that I was transitioning from psychoanalytic practice and completed my professional coach training, he flew to Houston to take me to dinner. A few years earlier, he left IBM in an early retirement as the lead healthcare industry person in the country at IBM to start his own corporation. He told me how he chose 5 very successful people, asked them to lunch or dinner, to pick their brains about what he was about to do, people who had done something similar to that. He advised me to do the same. It worked for both of us. Some business people with instant global recognition pick his brain for substantial picking fees. So, think about creating a support team, an advisory board, a networking group. Engage a mentor coach. Join a mastermind group. 9. Believing it's unspiritual to make significant money. There does not have to be a split between spirituality and money. Spirituality and profitability can be very compatible. There's nothing intrinsically unspiritual about money. It's one of those assumptions like starving artists. Why should someone of exceptional talent have difficulty converting that ability into significant income? Abundance, wealth, spirituality, those are all, in my view, synonyms. The antonyms, suffering, scarcity, non-spiritual. And remember, wealthy does not automatically equate with worldly riches. Rich and spiritual are synonyms. When someone says, I'm not in it for the money, I believe that person because I know the experience, unless it's a rationalization for not making a bunch of money. When you're truly immersed, passionate, and delivering immense value, this is synonymous with abundant income. It's the result when there's alignment, having a fantastic experience of bringing value to people. Charging what you're worth and bringing value are interwoven in a spiritual path. you will improve your health by creating less stress, as stress causes the body to be less healthy. You'll create an attitude and an experience of abundance, which will enhance your wellness. So there's something I'm not going over in detail here, other than just to highlight it. There's a detailed outline in your workbook about visualization and affirmation. Visualization is about rewiring your brain, because your brain can't tell the difference between whether something's coming in through the optic nerve or whether you're actually creating a vision of it. And when you repeat that vision over and over, first thing in the morning, last thing at night, you hardwire it. So you create an experience that you then can find a way to strategically back into that. Affirmations are the software component of that, the stories that support the visualization. So, and some of you have heard this story. Let's just do a brief exercise so you'll get a feel for it. A group of executives asked me to present a seminar to them on writing a first book. And this was a live experience. There were 24 of the executives there. And the first thing I did when I got to the podium is ask, how many of you have seen a yellow Jeep in the last month? So they looked at me like, are you serious? And finally, one person out of the 24 raised his hand. And I then went through a visualization exercise with them. Let's do it together. I'd like you to, you're already on mute, so you don't have to worry about that. I'd like you to close your eyes and get in a very relaxed position in your seat. Be aware of relaxing your entire body. Take a deep breath in of relaxation. Breathe out any tension. Another deep breath in of relaxation. Breathe out any tension. Keep your eyes closed and picture a yellow Jeep, the specific detail of how it looks. As you walk toward the Jeep, notice more of the detail, the bumper, the tires. As you walk around the back, notice the taillights. Notice the yellow side of the Jeep as you walk around. And as you walk all the way around back to the driver's side, reach out and open the door and feel the cool metal that you've grasped to open the door. Look inside at the seat, at the dash. As you sit in the seat and grab the wheel and look through the windshield, imagine driving it. Be aware of how firmly that seat holds you, how it smells, how it feels to grab the steering wheel. As you turn the key in the ignition, hear the sound of the motor, feel the vibration. Look again through the windshield as if you were driving. As you turn it off and get out of the Jeep, look back at it as you close the door, and then hear how firmly that door sounds as you close it. And as you walk away, turn around one more time to look at that yellow Jeep and to take it all in. Now, open your eyes. I ask the group if they happen to see a yellow Jeep. Remember, one had seen a yellow Jeep in the last month, only one of 24. I ask if anyone happened to see a yellow Jeep in the next week, would they email me or call me? Within the first 3 days, 22 of the people called to say they had seen a yellow Jeep. Now, what happened? The number of yellow Jeeps in the greater Houston area didn't suddenly increase, but they had cued their brain, they had cued their radar to perceive a yellow Jeep. Out of the millions of bits of stimuli that come in our reticular activating system every day, all the time, we cue our radar to be aware of what we selectively notice, what we take in as relevant data. Our software programs determine that. So this is something that you may think about doing to create a picture of what success will be for you, not of getting there, but of being in that successful experience. And what will happen in your brain as you create that experience of success, and notice from the example I gave, all of the sensory detail, there's more information about a neuroscience-specific way of going about developing a vision and developing the supporting affirmations, that the stories that will support that in your workbook. But what having that vision will do will create structural tension or dissonance in your brain, and then your brain will strive to close the gap between where you are and what you're envisioning. That's where you do strategic coaching, to look at a systematic way of planning. And remember, we've discussed this a number of times. Everybody has a goal. What distinguishes you as a mentor, as a successful mentor coach, is having a system that you've created to get to that goal, and having it be meaningful and in resonance with how the mind and brain works. So the key elements here are repetition. The neural networks dedicated to your vision must be renewed and repeated regularly. Be very specific about the experience of achieving the goal, and consciously incorporate this new vision into an ongoing story to be metabolized as part of yourself. In other words, as part of your identity. Now, and this is the P of the roadmap, to create a transformation of everything that you do and experience as part of who you really are and of your operating model. So you incorporate this new vision into the ongoing story so that it becomes part of your identity. And this is the key. You program your unconscious and create a future memory to live into, and your brain, remember, can't tell who conjured it. You are reality. The more specific your visual image, the more specifically etched your brain will be. This is, I think, a major part of why 95% of people who diet and lose weight gain back their weight. They don't reprogram their body image, the identity that they have vis-a-vis their body. So, affirmations reprogram your mind, visualizations rewire your brain. So here's an example about how our possibilities are only limited to the ones we allow ourselves to see. Major James Nesmith spent 7 years as a prisoner of war in North Vietnam. During the time he was in prison, he was essentially isolated and had no physical activity. Before the war, Major Nesmith was an average weekend golfer. He had broken 100 on two occasions. He had two 99s. Everything else was in triple digits. So, to preserve his sanity as a prisoner, he learned to visualize golf. He would select his favorite course. He pictured himself getting dressed, driving to the course, getting out, warming up, smelling the flowers, taking every shot, walking. He played golf about 7 hours every day in his mind. When he was released from captivity, playing golf in his mind 7 days a week for 7 years, his first outing, he shot a 74. This is the power of a vision of mind over matters. So, and this is, and we've discussed it not exactly head-on, but we've discussed it throughout, and I emphasize this probably as the most important aspect of the seven steps, the P to program new identity. This is part of what we do as mentor coaches, to help someone incorporate and see the changes that they're making as something that they've determined. They're a cause. The result is what they're doing. This can now be a part of who they are, what they're doing, ultimately a part of their identity. Because remember, as we've talked before, one of the most powerful forces of the human psyche is we always return to our identity. So unless we address this consistently throughout to transform how someone sees himself or herself along with the changes they're making, to see this as their authentic self and authentic actions, part of who they really are, That's what makes the change permanent. That's what makes it last, so that it becomes automatic. It becomes a habit. So, an overview of the seven steps. So we've examined your money story, money as reality and metaphor, the path, as well as the possession, and the power we give it, as well as its own power. We've taken a journey together now to illuminate and change your money story. We've reviewed these seven steps to recognize authorship of your money story, to own your story, to assess the plot and storylines, to decide what to change, to map the changes, to author, to bring about new experiences, and throughout to program new identity. In these seven steps, we've articulated some of the secret language of money, how some money issues are really about money, and how a bunch of other things hitchhike on money, and how our money stories are a large part of our life stories. These basic steps deconstruct how you write your money story and live it. They're building blocks to revise a money story or to write a new one. So let's add now how we can engineer effectiveness in doing this, some essentials of engineering an effective new money story. And these transcend all of these steps, each of these steps. One, make changes tangible and concrete. Construct a yardstick or a map to determine where you are and where you're going, to be able to measure progress along the way. That also lets you tell what's detour and distraction. And think about how we do that with each coaching session with each client. We create a map by getting the client to take ownership of the story of what they want to focus on, and then to determine where they want to get to, the success map destination. So they've created a map, and then we together, collectively, collaboratively, will go about creating a successful approximation of that. Two, make progress measurable. A specific destination, a tangible focus on the next step. Make progress visible. Small, specific, attainable steps, milestones that are visible, and then celebrate each small victory. Four, specify the next step. Not abstract, not global, not just the goal. Some is not a number, soon is not a time. Act healthier is not a strategy. All you ever have to do is the next right thing. This shrinks the change to immediate steps of effectiveness and the experience of momentum. One of the best examples of shrinking a task to a tangible next item is Alcoholics Anonymous, challenging its members to one day at a time. They've even said 1 minute at a time. It shrinks the change to a manageable, foreseeable, specific action. One day at a time focuses on the here and now. Tomorrow is an abstraction. A small target leads to small victories, the cumulative experience of effectiveness and mastery. So let's think about what we've just done. We've just adopted the scientific method to examine, to measure, to test, to consider change. The scientific method is a challenge to create a mindset of inquiry generates discomfort. It also catalyzes growth. Brain imaging studies have demonstrated where the self, the sense of self, resides in the brain, the medial prefrontal cortex. This part of the brain lights up when people self-reflect and make assessments and judgments. Brain, the neuroeconomics labs can measure and determine out of a large number of things when someone's eyes light on one particular object that lights up, that part of their brain, that sense of identity, that's the one out of the group they're going to buy. So this has a major impact in neuromarketing. A recent study found something I think also really important. The more clearly and fully that you can picture your future self, the more money you save for the future. Emily Pronin did the initial study at Princeton, did an initial study in this way. They found that people who can picture their future selves as in like age 70 and 80 will save 2 to 3 times as much as people who can't do that. Stanford has done some enhanced progression, aging with computers to show what it's going to look like, you know, if you continue smoking for the next 30 years or if you don't, and put those side by side, what it is going to look like if you gain 1 pound a year. For people where they did age progression into 70s and 80s, it across the board reflected in a greater savings rate by over 2 times as much for people who saw actual images of themselves age progressed over the computer of what they're going to look like. So here are a review of some guidelines. This is from a coaching perspective. Listen for the story that the source within you tells. Tell your story the way you want it to be in order to actualize it, to plan it, map it, and tell it begins its creation. Whatever you're living or experiencing in any way is the response to the story you're telling and living. If you want the story to change, you have to change the way you tell and live that story so that it shifts your feeling and thinking and action. This means that responses from others are not in the equation of its creation, unless you decide for it to be. Because everything you experience, you either create or agree to. This new telling needs to be in alignment with your identity, with who you are, especially your needs and ideals. In order to have a complete energy field and a full purposeful direction of that field going forward. When you practice the story that resonates with who you really are, your full energy and power become activated. All of you is going in the same direction. When that occurs, know the direction you're going and the goal and strategies of that pathway. To say that in a simpler way, look at the needs and ideals that you have or a client has, and be sure that those needs and ideals align with strategy and story going forward. That way, all of someone is going in the same direction. Now, here's a final story. For tens of thousands of years before books and computers, we transmitted our essence and principles by story. Story linked to the past, organized the present, and illuminated the future. Story allowed us to connect with each other's humanity and the paths crossed on the long journeys out of Africa to populate the rest of the world. Then the anatomy and physiology of our brains grew by putting thoughts and feelings into stories. Stories informed, instructed, inspired, governed, organized. Story is the most powerful way humans communicate. Stories give birth to possibility. Stories are a way that we resonate with our earlier selves, connect with others, and create a roadmap to proceed. Your story is yourself, your life, and what will survive you. At some point in the distant future, all that will be left of you, all that will survive you, is your story. Be sure to get it right. And here's a final exercise I'd like to do with you to, again, get relaxed, close your eyes. Take a deep breath in for relaxation. Breathe out any tension. And keep your eyes closed as you listen and reflect. This may be the turning point your grandchildren will tell stories about years from now. the time you leapt over the abyss to the other side of the Great Divide and began your life in earnest. On the other hand, this moment of truth may end up being nothing more than a brief awakening when you glimpse what's possible. But tell yourself, nah, that's too far to go. That's too far to jump. In that case, your grandchildren will have to be content talking about what delicious cookies you used to bake or what your favorite sports team was. It will all depend on how brave you'll be. Okay, we're in discussion mode now. If you'll please manage the background noise and be on mute until you're ready to talk. And I'm interested in thoughts and your input, questions, things that you'd like to talk more about. Let me ask you a question to prime the pump here to get you thinking about that. What do you think is the most common money mistake that we all make? What's your guess?
Common.
Anybody have a hunch or a guess that you'll share?
Do it again
one at a time. I didn't hear anyone.
Yeah, this is Wayne Halliday, and I'm just thinking that in my own life, it's always that it's going to get better. I don't have to worry about it. Just spend the money you've got now, and you can take care of the rest later.
Okay, that kind of internal bargaining that can justify the urge for right now. Okay, that relates. That's cool. I want to come back to that, so thank you for that. I heard a couple of other people. Would you go now?
Go ahead.
The internal bargaining, for sure.
Okay.
Internal bargaining, negotiating, because I can recall recently traveling to the Dominican Republic. And on retrospect, I now realize what a foolish decision I made as I sold a timeshare that I owned for years for a lifestyle share thing. It was a foolish decision. It was impulsive. I can clearly look at it now, even as we go through this. It was impulsive, not based on rational thought at all.
Okay.
And a lot
Thank
of warning
you for sharing
signs.
That. Those are great points that you're
Interesting.
Making. Would the other person jump in now, please?
Hi. Yeah, that mine kind of goes with both. It's the lack of management of money, of resources, money, and just not and spending too much, getting into debt because spending too much and mismanagement of.
Okay, those are all important insights and important self-reflection. I appreciate you sharing that. Does anyone else have any other input or ideas for you about what your answer is about a most common money mistake?
I would say that the most common money mistake is buying on credit.
Okay, to spend money you don't have. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Okay. Well, one thing that all of those have in common is to look at the opportunity cost of money.
Mm-hmm.
Opportunity costs are things that we lose, that we give away now or later in order to do something now. And that's something we usually don't consider in looking at money or spending it, is what's the opportunity cost? In a very simple way, and each of you have described some aspect of that, and this is kind of a common denominator. A very simple example is you've got a dollar, and there's an orange that costs a dollar and an apple that costs a dollar. So you spend a dollar on the apple. Well, the opportunity cost is you don't get the orange. You don't get to have the orange because you spent the dollar on the apple. Now, let's say you have $500 each week, and you don't go into debt. You're not going to get more, but you have a fixed amount, $500 each week. Beginning on Monday, that's all you can spend. No going into debt, no other income, $500. At the beginning of the week, you may not consider what you're giving up later in the week by having dinner and a drink. The opportunity cost on Sunday for doing this on Monday. So in the beginning, you buy an expensive shirt after dinner and a drink. And by Friday, you're looking at the whole weekend ahead, you've only got $42 left. The tough choice left on Sunday then, you can either buy a newspaper or a bagel with the remaining money, the New York Times or a bagel. And you can remember that dinner and drink and shirt of Monday. On Monday, there was an opportunity cost to consider, but it wasn't clear. It wasn't thought about. It wasn't in the foreground of thought, at least. And Sunday, the opportunity cost is finally clear, but it's too late. So this is something that may be important. Each of you mentioned an aspect of this, and this is just simply a different way of saying it, that we have to look at what we do and don't do with money and at opportunity cost. Thoughts or questions? What would be helpful for you to talk, for us to discuss? Are there aspects of what you've heard or what you've reflected on that you'd like to talk about?
When working with someone who has made, let's say they've made a lot of mistakes in terms of when you go through this entire list and they're sitting in front of you and they feel absolutely overwhelmed, like, point three, procrastination, four, inefficient energy, management, how to teach them, and of course it's step by step by step as we go through, you plan it carefully, but how to make sure you help them to self-regulate, to keep from spiraling into depression when you look at is that self-judgment that hits when you haven't gotten it right.
Okay. Let me give you an example, because this is a much simpler approach than working on helping someone get grounded and centered and then from that position looking at making the best decision. I was sitting in my library, my home office, and my wife came in and she said, "Well, how's it going?" I said, "Man, there were just a number of calls and I just have so much to do today. It just feels so overwhelming." And while she was spinning on one foot, her left foot, and leaving, she said, "Just pick one and do it." And of course she was right. I've done this. I've helped hundreds of people do that, but I needed it myself. And all the theories and all the ideas was just pick one, because when you do one thing, then that's going to create the sense of effectiveness. And that's the most basic motivation that we have as human beings, to have a sense of effectiveness. I've seen it, as some of you have heard, in direct infant observation studies of kids as early as 3 months of age, effectiveness, pleasure. And it goes till the last breath that any of us will have is the desire to be effective. So often the effectiveness is simply to shrink the change, to look at the next step, and then to create a system. That's the best thing that we can offer our clients in terms of changing a habit, creating a new behavior, is look at the system, not just the goal. The goal is abstract. Everybody has the same goal. But the system will help you know what the next specific step is, what you do the next minute, and then what happens after what happens next. So beginning in a very specific stepwise way is one way to start. And once that, we tend to repeat things that are pleasurable. We tend to repeat things that are responded to. Think about as parents. You respond to your child's behavior, good or bad. If it's bad, you're going to see more of it. If it's good, you're going to see more of that. We respond to what we repeat what is responded to because that's effectiveness. So, how do we do that? How do we convert that into coaching? In coaching, remember the first question we ask someone: what would you like to focus on? What's the effectiveness in that? Well, they own their story. People will commit, by the end of that story, the end of that session, people will commit to what they help create. You tell them what to do. Information is not going to do a darn thing. You've heard me say many times the result of information is not to change. You know, if information were enough, we'd all be thin. We'd have a lot of money saved up for the future. We'd eat mostly vegetables. We'd work out every day. Information is not going to do it. In fact, people who are really bright will have the boomerang effect and will dig in and entrench even more solidly because they'll find clever and really savvy ways to counter the information if it is not aligned with what they already know or the information they have. So it's not about information. We're not going to teach or train clients anything, but we can help them look at what they do next and create and achieve success strategies. Now, does that begin to answer that question for you?
Yes. Yes.
On a similar note, I wonder if you could address also building people's confidence in their money story.
Building
money
people's
management.
What? I didn't quite hear you.
Confidence.
Okay, building their confidence in what?
In their ability to rewrite their story and make changes.
Okay. Well, confidence is not something you can give somebody. Confidence is a state of mind. So when somebody, and there, I have a blog called that, Confidence is a State of Mind. It's archived in case it might be helpful for you to look. But confidence can result in successful and effective performance. So this is part of what we want to do in working with a client is when they take that step forward, when they do something that is effective, we want to highlight that. You know, that must have felt good to do that. Because what we know is two things. Whatever we do because we imagine how we're going to feel when we do it. So we are validating empathically that experience of somebody just having taken that successful step. And the other aspect is what we were just talking about. People tend to repeat what's responded to. So we're responding to the good stuff and highlighting it so that they can develop clarity, because the third thing that's happening while all this conversation is happening is they're unconsciously taking notes. They're downloading a system of how and who to be. They're downloading a model of how to perceive and organize and experience things and what to do to be effective. That's the identity change that's happening because they're internalizing the model that you and that client are co-creating about how to be effective, how to achieve and sustain performance and success. And that's what they're taking away with them and will have the rest of their lives. So your help, this is the P of the roadmap. You're helping them transform how and who they are. You're transforming their operating system. And the evidence is in the behavior and the experience of that behavior. Remember the equation we talked about first seminar. Belief drives behavior, behavior drives performance. It goes the other way to shape ultimately belief, and confidence is a belief in oneself that I can do it. And for someone needing to get in a performance zone and to cue themselves into that, that would be to enter that state of mind that houses both confidence and deliberate practice, as well as actually beginning to do it automatically without having to think about it. Now, does that answer your question enough to at least begin to think about how you might do it with a client?
Definitely, yes. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. And at times there may be a way that you will need to just simply help a client regulate a state of mind, because this may be what, let me give you an example. There may be two or three times, not that many over a number of years, but a client would call in at a time that we have a coaching appointment and describe something very briefly and say they're just so upset they can't possibly use the time. Could they reschedule? And each of the, I think, two or maybe three times, I have requested if we could just have a minute to do a brief relaxation exercise before looking at rescheduling. And the client inevitably agrees to do that. And I do a brief progressive relaxation, and it takes hardly more than a minute. And the client gets grounded and centered, and then we have a very productive session. Now, my contention is the most important thing that happened in that entire 50 minutes happened in the first minute, because that's a model for self-regulation in order to self-reflect. And I mentioned earlier in this series a couple of studies that were summarized in Scientific American Mind and Harvard Business Review found that the most important success factor is self-regulation and self-reflection, the ability to self-reflect and look at and observe oneself, as well as regulating oneself, meaning you can get grounded and centered and enter the state of mind that's specific for a certain task, one that houses the deliberate practice of that task. Thoughts, questions? Other things that we maybe didn't talk about enough or as much that you'd like to elaborate on, or challenges that you had with clients that kind of are in this ballpark?
Is it there?
Yes, hey, go ahead.
Yeah, I had this client there for many years, and he keeps making the same mistakes, eh, all the time. And it's actually borderline fraud on some of the money decisions he's made. Actually, no, it's not borderline, it is fraud. And so when I came down on him in the last time I spoke to him about it, and I think I talked quite straight to him. I wasn't mucking around or Are you sensitive to people still, even though they make those sort of mistakes, or do you expect to wait till they've totally changed their mindset?
When you hear someone, when you say a mistake, can you give me a specific example in one sentence of what you're calling a mistake? Just a succinct sentence of that.
So he gets to manage a client's fund, and it's a significant amount of money, and he misappropriates it and misuses it. I call that a mistake.
Okay. So he's committing a fraud, an illegal act, and
yes.
are you obligated to report that or do anything other than to continue work with him as a client?
Yeah, no, I have never reported. reported it, although I've been called, you know, on by an authority just to ask them questions about over it. And so I just gave them the truth of what I know, but without potting them.
In a sense, if we look at it in the cold, harsh daylight, you're colluding with him by not calling him on it and calling on him to address it and look at his behavior and how he decides on that behavior and to look at the consequences of it. Because if not you, then who would be in a position to help him look at that behavior? He has an attachment pattern with money that is fraudulent, and that story is being perpetuated. And of all the people in his life, only you, until he's caught and imprisoned, will be able to do that. So I would say, in a sense, it's and you may not agree with this, but I would say it's your obligation to him to do that. Because your obligation to him is to get him to look at what he's not looking at, to consider the consequences, and to align himself with what are operating principles that will be in his best interest, which he's not doing now.
So would you suggest that there's a need to receive a harsh reality check on it by taking him to the authorities?
No, I would begin with him to say, you know, let's have a difficult conversation. You're telling me you're doing some things that are illegal. How do you consider this? What conversation do you have in your mind to look at this and bypass what you know is, in a sense, wrong and illegal? How do you have a conversation to proceed? Help. Let's look at understanding that. You don't know, it sounds like, you don't know how his mind works, about how he justifies that, how he looks at it, if he's really looking at the concept. You don't know the whole story. There's the rest of the story here that you're not looking at, and if you don't look at it with him, nobody will. And let me give you the example that I've mentioned. This is minuscule compared to that, but it's still an example. And some of you have heard this. I was referred someone from a high-ranking executive on the executive team, board of directors, who was alienating everyone else in the executive suite, and they were all ready to fire him. He was ready to leave. And they said, well, you know, let's give him one last shot. Let's send him to Kruger. So he came to me, and guess what? He started annoying me tremendously, just like he had everybody else. So I considered that he was telling me the very best way he could, showing me what it was like to be him and what he needed work on. Now, I also knew that in order to do that, we needed a working alliance where we had an immersion in collaboration and trust, where I could get away with saying what I needed to about him and that attachment and that behavior pattern that was pissing off everybody, including me. First, I had to not take it personally, and then had to develop a working alliance so that he and I could grapple with that and look at it so that he could begin to look at changing. And it's a touch and go, but it was possible. So you've been working with him a long time, but what's the state of your working alliance? Can you get away with saying what you need to say with him and get to the position that you can say that in a way that's collaborative, that's from inside his experience, that he's not going to immediately interpret it as judgmental, critical, or pejorative, but speaking from inside his experience, his conversation about this, to see and develop his conversation, his pros and cons. He still has to have some struggle with this because he knows, at least intellectually, it's illegal. So there's going to be something going on that's coachable here. Now, he may not be willing to tolerate it. He may fire you because he wants to keep doing it. But at least you're not colluding with him, which you are now. I'm not saying that in a judgmental or pejorative way. I'm just saying both of you are going along calling it, you know, ultimately something illegal. And it took you a sentence or two to get there. So you know his experience. Does that make sense to you?
Yes. Well, it's been a big obstacle in my own mind about how to deal with it. Because,
well, one thing you have to think about, given everything is confidential and privileged, but if everything were on the table, if everything were known, would you be a named party in this because you have gone along with it? I don't know the answer.
Oh, yeah.
But you have to consider, if everything were known, where would you be?
Yes, indeed. I have actually been implicated in the first time that he did it.
You need to think seriously about that.
Yeah, and just by association. Mm.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, no, you're right. Yeah. And so when it happened again, it's like a habit, eh? And that's what I, you know, basically asking.
If it doesn't happen again, it needs to happen again because you bring it up. It's that important. It is not something you wait for. This is something, it's already happened, it's transpired. You have data, you have significant data. You don't need to wait for it to come up again. That I would say, might be a passive position. This guy is not taking a passive position. He's actively defrauding people. So I'd say go after it. You owe it to him. You owe it to whomever, but especially you. This can't set right with you, and it wouldn't set right with anybody that it's in front of, from the authorities to the ICF. I mean, anybody. So I think you're brave to mention it, and I appreciate that, so that we can talk about it, because sometimes there are things that we just have to do. Well, I know I said 10 minutes, so I know we're more than 15. I really appreciate each of you bringing so much of yourselves, the questions and the comments and the hopes in the beginning. There have been some of you who have indicated wanting to know more about New Money Story Mentor Training. I didn't want to talk about that during this time, but I'll send you some information about that. But thank you so much for participating. It's been a real privilege to work with you, to shape some of the comments and discussion around some of the questions. I hope I've answered them. I hope I've given you a kind of foundation to begin to look at some things in a different way and use the material that you have to enhance your coaching and then the enjoyability of it. So I hope you guys, I'll be eager to hear what you do with it and where you get to. So don't lose touch. Thank you so much. I've enjoyed it tremendously.
Thank you so much.
Bye now.
Thank
See you.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.